listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. I'm your host this week, Maria Young. On this West Virginia Week, flood assistance for storm victims in the Northern Panhandle and energy assistance for families in need. We'll tell you how upcoming federal cuts to SNAP programs will affect nutrition education here in West Virginia. Also, a mobile black lung screening program is back in operation, and how ocean lovers in landlocked West Virginia can help protect our seas. Let's jump right in now with a few short news stories. A judge in Raleigh County has ruled that religious exemptions to state school vaccine requirements must be honored. Chris Schultz has more.
The judge ruled Thursday the county must allow the children of families suing the county to attend school without vaccinations while their case continues. The ruling upholds an executive order issued by Governor Patrick Morrisey in January, granting religious and philosophical exemptions to the state school vaccination requirements. In June, the State Board of Education voted unanimously to direct Superintendent Michelle Blatt to advise schools to follow current vaccination requirements without religious exemptions. Soon after, Raleigh County mother Miranda Guzman sued the West Virginia and Raleigh County Boards of Education, arguing that their denial of religious exemptions infringed upon her child's religious freedom. In a press release, Governor Patrick Morrisey applauded the decision as a step forward in the administration's effort to defend religious liberty. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
After a long wait, residents in Ohio and Marion counties have been promised nearly $12 million in individual flood recovery assistance. Flash floods hit the Northern Panhandle on Father's Day weekend back in June, destroying homes, businesses, bridges, and roads, and claiming at least 8 lives. In a post on X shortly after approving the funds, President Trump said he looks forward to, quote, seeing the state make a full recovery. The approval means individual assistance is now available through the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, for those who sustained losses due to the flooding. Assistance can include emergency home repairs, private bridges and roads, temporary housing, transportation, moving, storage, and more. For more information on how residents of Marion and Ohio counties can apply for funding, visit our website at wvpublic.org. Governor Patrick Morrisey said Thursday he is continuing to seek additional aid for flood recovery efforts in Marion and Ohio counties. Low-income families who need immediate help paying their energy costs can apply for assistance through the West Virginia Department of Human Services. Applications to the Emergency Low-Income Energy Assistance Program will be accepted July 28th through August 8th, or until funds are depleted. Households with gas or electric utilities must present a termination notice when applying. Those with propane, kerosene, or other forms of fuel must show that their supply is low at the time of application. Eligibility for assistance is based on household income and size, starting with a maximum gross monthly income of $2,357 for a single person. In emergency situations, applicants must meet with a DOHS worker. For more information on eligibility and details on how to apply, visit our website at wvpublic.org. New testimony in an Appalachian Power case before the West Virginia Public Service Commission reveals bigger losses from operating 3 coal plants. Curtis Tate has more.
Appalachian Power lost more running its coal plants in 2024 and this year than it previously told state regulators, and the losses are forecast to continue into next year. That's what Kathy Kunkel of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis told the commission in written testimony filed this week. In April, company executive Jason Stiegel told the PSC that the company had lost $40.5 million operating its 3 plants because it had to burn down excess coal. Kunkel told the commission this week that the actual loss was more than double that figure, $81.1 million. The cost of operating the Amos, Mountaineer, and Mitchell plants exceeded the revenues the company earned from selling the power they generated in 10 months out of 12, she testified. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
Some county school districts have ranked nationally for improving student literacy. Chris Schultz has the story.
State education leaders are drawing attention to 9 counties that have improved literacy assessments by more than 3% since the COVID-19 pandemic. Cabell, Kanawha, Logan, Marion, Mercer, Monongalia, Ohio, Putnam, and Raleigh counties are among the 260 districts nationwide identified in the Dynamic Districts Report issued by Upswing Labs. It was reported at the State Board of Education meeting earlier this month that West Virginia joined Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina as the four states with sustained literacy increases. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, state education leaders have emphasized improving childhood literacy in the state with the launch in 2022 of the statewide literacy program called Ready, Read, Write, West Virginia. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection is accepting comments on its 2024 water monitoring report. Jack Walker has the details.
The department must compile its integrated water quality monitoring and assessment report every 2 years, documenting its efforts to comply with state and federal water pollution laws. The report outlines broad trends in water quality across the state, plus specific details about the water monitoring programs it has in place. With a draft version of its 2024 report complete, the department now seeks feedback from members of the public. West Virginia residents can provide comments on the report via email or paper mail. Public comments are due September 1. For more information, visit our website at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
A new study from Marshall University indicates flavored vapes pose a unique addiction risk. Here's Chris Schultz.
A new study on mice, led by researchers at Marshall University, reveals that flavor additives commonly used in e-cigarettes can enhance nicotine's effects on the nervous system. Brandon Henderson, associate professor of biomedical sciences at Marshall, says the study found that vaping some flavors like vanilla can stimulate one of the brain's key reward centers, even without nicotine present. He says the findings raise concerns about other understudied chemicals used in vape products and their impact on smoking cessation efforts.
I know kids that would never, you know, use a cigarette because, like, oh, that's going to be guaranteed cancer. But then they'll proceed to vape because they see that as a safer alternative.
Henderson, who has spent most of his academic career studying nicotine and cessation, says the best prevention is to not smoke or vape in the first place. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
A federal appeals court in Virginia will hear oral arguments in September in a lawsuit against Union Carbide. Curtis Tate has the story.
The Cortland Company and Union Carbide will present their case to the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia on September 11th. Cortland is asking the appeals court to reconsider a U.S. district judge's decision last year to not impose a permanent injunction ordering Union Carbide to stop the discharge of pollutants from its Philmont landfill in South Charleston. It asks the appeals court to reject a voluntary remediation agreement between Union Carbide and the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection for cleanup of the site. And it asks the court to consider increasing the civil penalties of $200,000 for violations of the Clean Water Act. Cortland filed its first lawsuit in 2018, seeking to stop water pollution from the Philmont landfill. The facility operated for nearly three decades, and as court testimony showed, it was never properly permitted. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
The League of Women Voters of West Virginia released a scorecard reflecting on the 2025 legislative session. Here's Jack Walker with the details.
The annual scorecard assesses how state lawmakers addressed policy areas of importance to women in the state. This year, that included protections for families, democracy, and equal rights, plus, quote, creating a sustainable future. Director Judy Ball says the scorecard broadly suggests lawmakers did not adequately address material needs in the state, things like childcare, public education funding, and health access.
So we're hoping in the future that the legislature will pay more attention to what the people want.
The online scorecard is interactive. For more information, visit our website at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jack Walker in Shepherdstown.
It took 5 years for the family of a man who died in the custody of jail guards to find justice. On Thursday, they were recognized for their perseverance. Zachary Bailey died shortly after he was brought to the North Central Regional Jail near Parkersburg in July 2019. A family attorney says they were told it was from an overdose. The family won a civil case against the Division of Corrections and Rehabilitation last year after testimony found Bailey asphyxiated during a beating. Attorney Jesse Forbes helped the West Virginia Association for Justice present the family with its Advocacy for Justice Award.
I mean, just last week, we had a federal judge put jail guards in prison for a very long time for a similar issue. And those are things you didn't see 5 years ago.
The Division of Corrections and Rehabilitation declined comment. A mobile black lung screening program is back in operation. As Curtis Tate reports, it was part of a dispute over federal spending cuts.
For weeks, the mobile black lung clinic sat behind the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health office in Morgantown. During that time, government workers, unions, and lawmakers pushed back on Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for freezing a program that helped coal miners with black lung disease. In May, a federal judge ordered the program to resume, and many of its workers went back to work. The mobile clinic finally resumed last week, stopping in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Next week, from July 29th to 31st, the clinic will be set up at Milan Park in Morgantown. According to a schedule published by NIOSH, it will then go to Mannington on August 5th and Grantsville, Maryland on August 27th. Those who participate can expect results in 8 to 10 weeks. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins will be accepted. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
You're listening to West Virginia Week, and now some of our top feature stories from the past week. Good nutrition is a cornerstone of a healthy lifestyle, but is often out of reach for millions of Americans with limited resources. Programs like the Family Nutrition Program that encourage the adoption of healthy lifestyle behaviors will soon lose most of their funding after the passage of the Trump administration's Big Beautiful Bill. Kristen McCartney is the director of SNAP Ed at WVU Extension Services. She spoke with reporter Chris Schultz about what cuts to SNAP Ed will mean to communities across the state.
Can you tell me what it is that WVU Extension does?
WVU Extension is part of the land grant system of universities. So with that designation, Extension's role is really to take the knowledge that's generated at the university and then translate it for people in the communities. So really anything that's applicable to people in the communities that can help them have a better life.
How does that mission connect to food and nutrition for West Virginians?
Particularly with the West Virginia Family Nutrition Program at Extension, we've really focused on different parts of the food system and how they interact with individuals. So, you know, this concept of nutrition security, food security is just, do you have money to buy food? But nutrition security is really looking at what is your individual capacity or the community's capacity to access healthy, nutritious foods. From the ground up, literally, you know, we have Grow This, which is focused on helping people learn how to garden. We also have programs that provide basically free fruits and vegetables to kids or to folks with chronic diseases through our kids market at the store and our pharmacy programming. We provide nutrition education and cooking classes, and even up to the level of working with WVU Food Justice Lab on establishing food policy councils locally so that they can coordinate different types of food access.
Can you explain to me what role or what percentage of your funding comes from those federal funds?
So the West Virginia Family Nutrition Program is really supported through two different funds from the USDA. One is called FNAP, or the Expanded Food and Nutrition Program. I mean, that's specifically allocated to Extension and focused on the nutrition education piece. That's really only one third of the Family Nutrition Program's budget. The other two thirds were provided through SNAP Education, which is the one that was eliminated in HR 1. And so obviously it was a bigger portion of funding, so that allowed for a greater reach. SNAP Ed is really focused on policy systems and environmental change that go along with that education. So while it's needed and necessary to provide education on how to prepare healthy meals or to eat healthily, if a community doesn't have access to healthy foods, then it's really hard for them to engage in that behavior.
That work to ensure the health and prosperity of West Virginians is going to be impacted by this cuts. Do you have any concept at this time of how these cuts are going to impact West Virginians' health and well-being?
I really don't. I think, you know, the biggest part of SNAP Ed, the biggest benefit was just the integration work. So SNAP Ed's mission was very broad and, you know, like do the things in the community that will help support healthier behaviors and decisions. And really, SNAP Ed was not siloed into one thing. So you think about other things related to food and health, like, you know, food pantries. And what SNAP Ed really did was link those things together and try to make it a more cohesive story for people in the community, you know, where all the messaging around healthy eating and active living were integrated and supporting each other. It's hard to conceptualize, you know, the role of that like integrative work and what will happen when that's not there. There's been a lot of trying to figure out, you know, how do we keep the work going without the people in place. It's really been a challenge. The good thing is we've always approached our work in the way of how do we make this so it's sustainable and that it does keep going if we're not here. But really kind of like putting that into practice has been a big challenge. It's in identifying, you know, who are the partners that can keep this going.
Is there anything that I haven't given you a chance to discuss with me? Or is there anything that we've touched upon that you'd like to highlight at this time?
The other piece of this that, you know, we keep trying to figure out is, you know, the disconnect between, you know, what we're hearing, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s, you know, the MAHA approach and those things, which, you know, tied in so perfectly with many of the things we were already doing. And, you know, it just seems like such an oversight to lose a program like SNAP Ed that's perfectly situated to really bring to life some of those ideas related to food and nutrition and physical activity that we've heard are the priorities of the MAHA movement. So, I guess that once, you know, because of all this advocacy that's happened to try to retain SNAP Ed, that maybe we'll be able to rejuvenate the program at some point and get back the momentum we've lost.
That was Kristen McCartney speaking with Chris Schultz about the effects of federal funding cuts to local SNAP Ed programs. To read a longer version of this interview, visit our website at wvpublic.org. NPR's flagship science podcast, Short Wave, is doing a special 8-part series on the ocean this summer called Sea Camp. News director Eric Douglas, who is an accomplished diver and ocean advocate himself, spoke with the hosts, Emily Kwong and Regina Barber, to learn more about the series.
Tell me about what Short Wave is.
You want to take that, Emily?
Yeah. This show has been around since 2019. And in just 15 minutes, we bring listeners new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. And the show comes out 4 days a week. So we cover everything from what the cuts at the federal level, how they affect local communities. We talk about the latest in animal research. We talk about new comets visiting from other solar systems. And we have a new series out every Monday where we go deeper and deeper through the different levels of the ocean.
We get Shark Week. We get, you know, all this stuff, which is kind of pseudoscience, sensationalized stuff.
But I would say last year we did Space Camp. So for the summer, we focused on a lot of stuff. So my background is in astrophysics, and we really focused on, you know, having this idea where we were going from Earth and talking about like junk in space, you know, satellites. And then we went all the way to like the end of the universe, you know, right. And so we kind of wanted to do something like that this year in an area that we also know very, very little about. We also, there's just so much we can learn and we can get every single day. So we wanted to have something like that. We wanted to do something very similar where we'll start from the top of the ocean down to the bottom. And that's how the series is going to go.
So tell me why the people in landlocked Middle America should care about the ocean. What did you learn from your reporting that they should know?
The ocean is like our lifeline in the air we breathe. And just because it's out of sight doesn't mean it should be out of our minds. And so that looks like purchasing sustainable seafood. That looks like buying sunscreen that is safe for coral reefs. That looks like educating your children about how to be gentle with ocean creatures. If you take them, if they're lucky enough to go to an aquarium or, you know, they themselves go fishing. I think it's just recognizing we are like one species out of untold, probably billions on this planet. And we want humans to keep going, right? And the way to do that is to live in a kind of respect and harmony with all the other species we share the planet with.
I think another thing to think about just everyday life is shipping lanes. You know, like we get all of our stuff from a lot of boats, a lot of things that are going through. And one of our episodes, we talk about like ocean currents and how they make shipping and sailing so much faster. Emily has been trying to get me to read this book called Longitude, and I'm reading it now. And it's just fascinating. There's so much history with our ocean, and it's so beautiful and it's so interesting. And I think if anyone just kind of thinks about, I mean, I don't know if we all like pirates, but I like pirates. And, you know, like, and like, you know, there's just so much stuff that happened in the ocean. There's so much history. There's so much of our, mm-hmm. our American culture and like other people's cultures that really did, what do I want to say, originate from stuff that happened through shipping. I mean, sad stuff and good stuff. And it's just, I think the ocean is just so interesting and so mysterious. And that's what we're going to talk about. I think mystery is another really attractive thing for.
There's probably lessons in rural communities in West Virginia that everyone needs to learn from as far as respecting the ocean. Like I think that some of the most estrangement from the ocean can actually happen within spaces where they live right next to it, you know? Right. And so,
yeah.
If anyone from West Virginia has a story that they want us to investigate regarding the environment, or just science in general, if you have a space question, Regina's so good at going into those. You can email us at shortwave@npr.org and we'd love to look into it for you.
To Emily's point, like people do take the ocean for granted. I grew up on the West Coast my whole life. And I remember some people being like, I've never seen the ocean before. And how like amazed they were when they finally saw it. And they were like, oh my gosh. And I loved that. And I think Emily's right. I think that there's... even though maybe West Virginia is landlocked, I think there is probably a lot of people that are like, the ocean is amazing. And either I really want to see it because I haven't before, or like, I can't wait to get back because it's beautiful.
You know, what do we need to do in West Virginia to keep the water clean, whatever mm-hmm. that affects downstream?
Oh, all the water from the ocean is a part of our water cycle. And so protecting the health and cleanliness of rivers and tributaries that then drain into watersheds and basins that lead to the ocean is ultimately like just, again, part of being a good steward on planet Earth. So it's not just like out there. What happens to the ocean is always going to come back to haunt us eventually.
That was NPR's Shortwave podcast hosts Emily Kwong and Regina Barber speaking with Eric Douglas about the ocean, why it is important to people in landlocked states, and their new summer series, Sea Camp. West Virginia singer-songwriter Ella Hanshaw wrote hundreds of songs, many of which she sang in church. Hanshaw self-recorded many of them, but never sought a record contract. She died in 2020 at the age of 85, but some of those recordings are getting a new life. Inside Appalachia's Mason Adams spoke with Kelly Kearney, Hanshaw's granddaughter, about Ella Hanshaw's Black Book, a record released by the record label Spinster.
We're talking about Ella Hanshaw's Black Book, a collection of your grandmother's songs. I reckon you've known her from the time you were born. What are some of your earliest memories of Ella Hanshaw?
I'd say that my earliest memories of Ella are more of a feeling than a memory. I was in Sunday school, and my teachers were talking about heaven and trying to explain what heaven was to us. And they said, just imagine your favorite place on earth filled with your favorite people, and that's what heaven is. And so for years after that, whenever I thought of heaven, which was a very common thought for a young Pentecostal, whenever I thought of heaven, I thought of myself with Mama on her hill in West Virginia. We made a trip down once a year from Ohio, and that was basically a time I had like 1 week with her every year, and I loved these trips. I vibrated with excitement on the way down, even though there wasn't much to do there but roam around and collect ticks. I didn't have my bike, you know, she didn't have many toys. But still, I was so excited to just get down there and do nothing. And Ella was the entire reason for these intense feelings. She brimmed with love. And as fiercely talented as she was, she always had room for me. And I remember she would be singing songs, doing quartet practices, and she just incorporated me into the process. I'd be sitting on her green carpet, and they'd be there recording songs just on a cassette player. And decades later, as I was restoring these tapes, I would hear some kid making a racket in the background. And I was just like, damn it, is that me ruining the song?
Ella Hanshaw wrote and performed music throughout her life, but she never became a recording artist. The Black Book Collection includes a number of her demos and home recordings over the years. So how did you all come across these recordings?
So it was all very serendipitous. In 2013, my husband and I were driving through West Virginia on our way back from a backpacking trip in Monongahela. And we were flipping through the radio, just looking for something. And I hit a station and I just felt like I'd been hit by a bus. And all these memories came rushing back. And I had not thought of or heard Mama's music in 15 years. And suddenly there it was. I mean, it wasn't her music. And I was just shocked. And I said, this sounds like Mama. And Ethan hit the brake on the highway. He's like, Mama sounds like this? This turned out to be the Meyer sisters from Georgia, from Art Rosenbaum's Art of Field Recording. I just started to think about the music, and there was no way to really know. I doubted myself. I was like, maybe she wasn't that good. Maybe my memory was wrong. I didn't know anything about music at the time. And it's been so long. And so there was really no way to know or figure it out. But then there was a sad turn just a couple months later. My other grandmother had died. And I ended up going back home for the first time in years. And I was at my brother's house, and we were just talking, and I just asked him, I was like, do you remember Mama's music? Do you remember being that amazing? And he just got up, and he went into his garage, and he came back with one tape. And he just said, I stole it. She's got a ton more just sitting in boxes.
That was Kelly Kearney speaking with Mason Adams about singer-songwriter Ella Hanshaw. To hear the rest of that story and more, listen to Inside Appalachia Sunday mornings at 7 and Sunday evenings at 6 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And that's it for this edition of West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here again next week. As always, you can see these stories and much more at wvpublic.org. I'm Maria Young.